Support for 51% comes from Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment, working within the community to better Berkshire County one basket at a time. Berkshire.coop.
On this week's 51%, a writer from the Midwest pens a memoir of hunger and disordered eating with a message about ageism.
I don't like the message this culture sends to people, especially women, about aging.
And we learn about women in the earlier days of Greenpeace. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I need bread and water. Man, that's all I need. Bread and water. Place to rest my feet.
From adolescence to deep into middle age, Lisa Knopp has struggled with an eating disorder. Severe food restricting left her sick at ages 15, 25, and 54. It was her most recent battle that left her wondering if eating disorders and disordered eating are caused by the same factors as those in younger women, or are they caused in part by aging in a culture that views midlife and beyond as a time marked by deterioration, powerlessness, and irrelevance? Knopp, an English professor at the University of Nebraska-Omaha and author of 5 collections of essays, also wanted to know how she could ever heal from a condition that is caused by a tangle of genetic, biological, familial, psychological, economic, spiritual, and cultural forces. The result of her inquiry and exploration is Bread, a memoir of hunger. I asked her why she wrote the book and why now.
I came to this book in kind of a roundabout way. I was working on a collection of autobiographical essays, and I decided that I would write an essay about my love of bread. And I was writing about bread as symbol and the joy of making bread. And, I've had a little problem with eating in the past, with restrictive eating. And it's kind of related to bread. And I didn't want to do too much with that, but I did mention it. And that part of the essay kind of got out of control. And I ended up writing about something that I had really tried not to think about for a long time. I showed the essay to a couple friends and they said, you've got a book here. So it came out of an essay that really got out of hand, an essay that was, 20, 25, 30, 35 pages. It kept growing. And the story that was pressing to be told was the story about my 3 episodes with restrictive eating, what I call my malady.
Please talk more about what you're calling your malady and what came back to you as you say your essay grew out of control.
Well, there have been layers of awareness from writing this, but I guess I had trouble even thinking about myself as having a problem, even though I've had 3 episodes where I got pretty sick from restrictive eating. The first time was when I was 15, and in response to a difficult family situation, I restricted myself to 600 calories a day. And I was exercising a lot, and I lost a lot of weight and got pretty anemic and stopped menstruating, and my hair was coming out. And I was in a pretty unhealthy place, but I would have told you that I felt pretty triumphant because by restricting what I ate, I was making myself safe. I felt safe through that. And also that I had conquered something. So that was the first episode. The doctor examined me and said, you need to go home and eat more. This was 11 years before Karen Carpenter made anorexia and bulimia household words. And I honestly don't think he knew what he saw. I regret that I didn't get treatment then. But I kind of moved back to normal eating. It would never be innocent again. But I was fine until I was 24, 25, 26. And then, again, in response to a difficult life situation, I started restricting, but this time it was more of a food phobia that I was afraid that somebody would taint or poison my food. And So then I took different measures to make myself safe. It was not only not eating much, but the food had to be where nobody could touch it or have contact with it. And that lasted for about 3 years. And what finally ended it was the birth of my son. The unhealthy thinking just started dropping away, and I returned to, you know, more or less normal eating. And that was the state of things for the next quarter of a century. And then when I was 54, I started restricting again. But I couldn't see that. I thought I was just trying to make myself healthy. I had a food allergy, and I had some digestive troubles. And so I thought that by not eating certain foods and by not eating very much of anything, I could make myself healthier. And I kept becoming more and more restrictive. And finally, my 20-year-old daughter said, you know, this is a real problem, and if you don't start eating more, you're going to die. She said, this isn't just something to make you healthier. She called it an eating disorder. And I wish I could say that snapped me back into awareness and reality, but it didn't. It still took several months and a lot of work on an essay about bread and research into midlife eating disorders that really awakened me to what was going on. And what I realized is that once again, I was restricting so that I could be safe. And what didn't feel safe in my life is that a lot of people had left all at once. Both of my children had moved out, as children are supposed to, and moved on with their lives. And some people had died, some people had moved away, and it just felt like overwhelming loss to me. And then I also realized that I was getting older, and I don't like the message this culture sends to people, especially women, about aging, that as we get older, we're going to become less relevant, less valuable, less productive, less autonomous, less visible. And once I started fighting that message, I started becoming healthier. But I think for a while I was just kind of unconsciously believing that was going to be my future. And I didn't want that. I had to go in search of resistance narratives and women who could be models for me about how to live their later years on their own terms as final functioning and visible women.
Who did you find as models?
Who did I find as models? Well, Helen Mirren and Meryl Streep. There's some actresses that I think are pretty amazing. There's some painters that I like. George O'Keefe is one of them. And, why is her name escaping me at the moment? The woman?
In the arts?
No, and she works with primates.
Jane Goodall.
Yes. That woman is out giving presentations like most days of the year. You know, she's very fierce and passionate about her work and is not stopped by aging.
You know, Lisa, we all have things in our lives that we choose to process differently, right? And I'm wondering, because this memoir is so intensely personal, why you chose book form as opposed to, say, a journal, something more private? I mean, I'm assuming you want to help others.
A good question, because I grieved over this book and I continue to squirm a bit over it. It's very personal. It's very confessional. People that read the book, I've noticed two dominant reactions. One response is I never hear anything from them about the book. And I think for some people, eating disorders and disordered eating are not real problems. And then there's another response, and that's almost always women who come to me with such gratitude. And what they will say is, I've always struggled with eating. I don't have an eating disorder, but you've given me a name for what I have, which is disordered eating. Unhealthy food-related behaviors that don't meet the clinical diagnosis of an eating disorder but can cause a lot of misery in one's life. And women who are really grateful that I've told my story. And so I feel pretty vindicated by that. I just went back and forth on whether this was something that I wanted to go public with. I suppose that what I want people to get from this book, what I feel almost evangelical about, is that I want people to know that our culture gives us many messages about ourselves that aren't healthy, and about where we should go when we're hungry. And I want people to ask themselves what they're truly hungry for. And it's probably not food.
I wanted to ask you about the multi-layered title, bread. What does it mean for you?
Well, I call it bread because bread means so much to me. When I grew up in the late 50s and 60s and into the 70s, pre-sliced white bread was what we ate. It was, you know, it was this industrial marvel. A woman didn't have to stand in the kitchen and bake bread. You could just buy it and it was ready to go. It was my first binge food. I would binge on slices of white bread and then feel pretty sick afterwards because of all the chemicals in it. When I was in ninth grade, I wanted to take band and art. I was a real artsy kid, and because of a scheduling fluke, I couldn't take art, so I took Foods 1, and we learned how to bake bread that semester. And I think it was the first homemade bread I had. It was ninth grade, and I just thought, this is the best thing I've ever tasted, and I really love baking bread. And so even though I came from an industrial white bread family, I started baking bread, and my family liked it too. And also, I was raised as a Christian and am a Christian now, and so the communion ritual is really, really meaningful to me, the idea that I symbolically take Jesus into my body through a tiny little piece of bread. When I was in the second episode of my malady, I started baking bread every Saturday morning, and this was a healing ritual for me. After a hard week, my first year teaching high school classes and various things I was struggling with, just to be able to spend a Saturday morning kneading bread and baking it and eating a warm slice was very grounding and healing. And then finally, the way bread ends is that I have created another healing ritual involving bread, and that is eating a piece of bread every morning, bread that I've baked, and doing it with complete mindfulness so that I'm doing nothing but eating bread, nothing but thinking about eating bread and experiencing the bread going from the plate and into my body. And I've grown to believe that mindfulness is, I think it's the answer to just about everything, but in particular, my struggles with restrictive eating, just being really mindful and present in the act of eating and being aware of what is going on. One other aspect of bread that I play with in my memoir, again, when I was growing up in the 60s, to say that something was so white bread was a really derogatory thing to say about it. It was saying that it was very middle America and kind of vapid. And when I was a child, I was just wanting so badly to get out of my white bread life. I grew up in a middle-class, white, Protestant, middle America family. And I didn't want to do what many people in my hometown were doing, which was, oh, maybe for me getting a secretarial job and, you know, hoping to someday have two cars in the driveway and a nice house. I wanted to have something other than a white bread lifestyle. Of course, now I look at my hometown and see some pretty fine things there. Some of the things I wanted to escape when I was young, you know, have some appealing aspects to them. But the idea among hippies and war protesters and counterculture types that white bread was just, that was just about as bad as it could get for a person to be associated with industrial white bread from which all the nutrition and fiber and color had been taken.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention, something real important to get out there?
You know, I think what makes my book different than other memoirs about eating disorders and disordered eating, not that there are that many memoirs on disordered eating, but I really want to stress age. A lot of people aren't aware of how many older women have disordered eating and eating disorders. And older women can hide that in ways that girls and young women cannot. A lot of older women live alone. They do have some health problems. Nobody's going to give them any flack about going to buy a bunch of laxatives at the grocery store or whatever. So it's hidden in older women. A pretty conservative estimate is that 10% of the people with eating disorders are older women, but it's probably higher because, you know, we hide it so well. And I have read some interesting research linking it with aging, you know, discomfort or fear, not so much of aging, but of ageism. Ageism is the problem. And I think that is what makes my book different from others, because the third episode of my malady, it hit when I was 54 years old, and I don't know if I will ever be entirely free of it. I'm well nourished, and my weight is stable, but the very restrictive thinking is there, and the sense that, you know, if life gets too dangerous, I can make myself safe by not eating. I don't know if that will ever go away.
That was Lisa Knopp, author of Bread, a memoir of hunger. Two brands that represent women in, well, a different sort of light are Playboy and Hooters, and both have announced some changes. First, naked women are back in Playboy magazine, ending a year-old ban on the nudity that made the magazine famous. Playboy celebrated the reversal on Twitter and Facebook with the hashtag #NakedIsNormal. The about-face has come with the release of Playboy's March-April issue. The magazine had banished naked women from its print edition because it felt the content had become passé in the era of easily accessible online porn. But Cooper Hefner, Playboy's chief creative officer and the son of magazine founder Hugh Hefner, recently called the nudity ban a mistake in a Twitter post. Cooper Hefner said the magazine is reclaiming its identity. Playboy declined further comment. I depart from delivering the news and offer the following. Yes, nudity is normal, but in this case it also is well choreographed, often depicted in submissive fashion and manipulated, think airbrush and, oh, what photo applications can do, as is the case with many magazines. And back to the news. Then, headed in a somewhat different direction is Hooters, which is hoping people really do like it for its food. Hooters Management Corporation, a licensee of Hooters of America, says it just opened a restaurant that does not feature waitresses in tight tops. The Hoots restaurant outside Chicago has people ordering at the counter rather than at tables from female and male employees. CEO of Hooters Management Corporation Neil Kiefer says the restaurant in Cicero, Illinois, is a test and it will serve only about a dozen menu items, including chicken wings. The move comes as the restaurant industry faces flat customer traffic, though fast food places are expected to steal business from sit-down chains. That's according to the NPD Group. These days, global environmental group Greenpeace is defending the forest against palm oil companies and standing up against the Dakota Access Pipeline, to name a very few of the activist group's causes around the world. During Women's History Month, it's time to take a look at a few of the women of Greenpeace and bring their accomplishments to the fore.
Now, women were integral to creating Greenpeace, and soon they were on boats, too. So I didn't want to hear more about these women, so I asked Bob Hunter's longtime wife, Bobby Hunter, and she told me about Anne Marie Horn. Anne Marie Horn was on a Greenpeace boat headed to French Polynesia in the southern Pacific Ocean because France was doing nuclear weapon testing there.
In 1972, Greenpeace hired David McTaggart to take his sailboat and sail to a nuclear testing site, French nuclear testing site in the island of Mururoa. At that time, he brought along a crew, including his girlfriend, Anne-Marie Horn. Anne-Marie, in my mind, was the first female to have been involved in a direct action with Greenpeace, because what happened on that fateful journey was that the French commandos boarded David's sailboat and beat him up. Anne Marie had the presence of mind to take photos of the thing, race downstairs, and hide the canister on her person, and very soon after, jump off the boat and get the canister to the right hands, i.e., my husband, Bob Hunter, who had the presence of mind to send it viral to all the news networks. Without that happening, without Marie and without Bob's presence of mind, all the effort of that trip would have been for naught.
Soon, Bobby herself was on a boat trying to stop whaling.
I was the second woman to be involved in direct action, and I was in the second year of the whale campaigns, 1976. I stood in front of a whale harpoon to save a whale. That year, they didn't shoot over my head. We actually stopped the fleets, and the whales all went off to their freedom. At that time, no pictures of that event, other than some of us standing there going, well, that worked.
That sort of matter-of-factness seems to characterize Bobbie Hunter's approach to her work with the fledgling environmental organization. As her daughter Emily Hunter says, her mother just got on with it, and that important behind-the-scenes work was hard to highlight in the film.
I'd been researching for this film for a couple of years now, and we'd gone through a lot of my dad's old archives, some of the Greenpeace archives, stills and video footage, really focused a lot on trying to tell the stories and the people that weren't even as well known. You know, in that process, I found that I could uncover certain pieces of the stories of some of the co-founders, but when it came to my mother, it was like she wasn't even there in history. You know, there's about one or two pictures of her, and beyond that, there's almost no recording of her part. And yet, she played a pivotal role. I mean, people, you know my dad's name, Robert Hunter. They know maybe Rex Weiler. They know Paul Watson for sure. You don't hear about, you know, Carly Truman or Bobbie Hunter. And yet, my mom, she played an instrumental role. I mean, she was there as one of the first treasurers of Greenpeace. What that meant is she literally was given a box with nothing more than a few pennies in it and a couple of IOU notes. So she started literally from scratch, where she helped take the organization and raise large numbers of funds through lotteries and through innovative fundraising in order to get those first couple of boats and even help steer those first couple of campaigns. And beyond that, she was also got involved in some of the actions. She was the first woman to put herself out there, put her body out there, and block a harpoonist and help save the life of a whale. And yet, again, we don't know anything of her story. And even when I tried, and so did the director, Jerry Rothwell, we both really tried to have more of my mother's story told, it was almost impossible because there was just nothing to work with in terms of materials. And that was a real shame. That was a real unwriting of history, I felt.
History is written and rewritten, and this film, How to Change the World, has an important cut line under that title, The Revolution Won't Be Organized. There were no risk assessment or logistics people on these boats. Okay, this is what I mean. Having rented a boat to sail out to try and stop whaling, they set off looking for a Russian whaling ship. The boat is running out of fuel. They decide there's really only one thing to do. And what is it? Listen to the only woman on board as she watches her comrades decide what to do next.
Cormac said to Hunter, "We have 2 days of fuel left." The question was, were we going to run for San Francisco without an encounter with the whalers, or were we going to stay out and try and find them? And of course, that has huge consequences for Cormac. If he has to have a tow, I mean, this is big bucks that we're talking for John. Hunter, Pat Moore, and David Garrett come by, and they have got the I Ching, and they have got the coins, the three coins. I have no idea what the I Ching is. I've never heard of this book. I've never seen it. But of course, it's a book of divination, right?
The Chinese word, which means approach, has a range of meanings.
I thought, I have joined a ship of fools.
The ancient explanations in the Book of Changes give as its first meaning becoming great.
Hunter throws one that says success. It furthers one to cross the great waters. There are four hexagrams out of the 64 that have that, and it just means good fortune, supreme good fortune. He's thrilled. He thinks that we should go and keep chasing whales, right? Pat Moore threw it, and he gets a second one of the four hexagrams. David throws it, and he gets a third one. I'm saying, what the hell are you guys doing? What, you're going to consult some kind of oracle for this decision? And they said, you throw them. And I went, oh, yeah, right. You guys, this is BS. And I threw them, and I got the fourth one. And we went out, and the next day we found the Russians.
This Women in Greenpeace history story was produced by Mary Ambrose for a Greenpeace podcast segment series. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1440.